Our lesson continues in the second psalm. We've gotten through the first 9 verses of this psalm, and we have the last 3 verses, verses 10 through 12, yet to go. This psalm is about the Messiah. It tells about the fact that the heathen are raging or having a tumultuous exercise, and that the people are imagining a vain thing in their opposition to the Messiah. It talks about those that would oppose him. The kings of the earth have set themselves, and the rulers of the earth have taken counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed. They want to break out from his bands or from his yoke. They do not want to be subject to him or to his law. And then we've seen in verses 4 through 6 the attitude that God in heaven has toward this. He that sitteth in the heavens shall laugh, and the Lord shall have them in derision. Then he shall speak unto them in his wrath, and vex them in his sore displeasure. And he says, yet have I set my king upon my holy hill of Zion. Then in verses 7 through 9, we have the response of the Messiah himself. The Messiah tells what his position is, and also what the Father has said to him. He says, I will declare the decree. That is, he's going to declare the things that God has given him to place in his kingdom. The decree, the law, that's going to be applicable to his kingdom and to his followers. And this decree says, the Lord has said unto me, thou art my son, this day have I begotten thee. Ask of me, and I shall give thee the heathen for thine inheritance, and the uttermost parts of the earth for thy possession. Thou shalt break them with a rod of iron, thou shalt dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. And so that brings us down through the 9th verse, and we commented on these verses in detail in our earlier lessons. Now we move into the 10th verse, and we have a change of person now as to who is speaking. Now we have the psalmist speaking. The psalmist is giving some advice, giving a warning, giving a conclusion now as to what should be done after what has been said in the first 9 verses. He begins in the 10th verse by saying, be wise now, therefore, O ye kings. This is the time for wisdom. This is the time to do the right thing. And if you're going to do the right thing, if you're going to act according to wisdom instead of according to folly, you're going to listen to what I have to say to you. Be wise now, therefore, O ye kings. And then he says further, be instructed, ye judges of the earth. This word for judges can be interpreted as rulers. Some seem to think that it means those that are in lesser authority than the kings, those that are ruling under the direct authority of the kings. And we have to realize that at the time this psalm was written, the kingdom were all ruled by some kind of a king, some kind of a official that had supreme power and authority. There were no so-called democratic types of governments like we have them today. And so we'd have to interpret this as it's applied then to all governments, whatever type of government is involved. And this would be included in this idea of the rulers or the judges. And so it says, be instructed. And this word, be instructed, means to be exhorted or to be warned. To learn something here that's going to improve yourself. Take the warning. Realize that there is something that you must not neglect about this fact of the Son of God and His kingdom and His rule. Be instructed, you judges of the earth. Be warned. This is the psalmist talking now. Instead of raging and having some kind of a tumultuous uprising against him, instead of imagining or thinking a vain thing or things that are going to be vanity, things that are not going to come to any good end, instead of setting yourselves against him, instead of taking counsel together against him, instead of trying to break out of his bands and cast away his cards, that is, his yoke from us, instead of doing that, be instructed as to what is the wise course of action. What should you do instead of opposing him? What should you do instead of neglecting him? And in verse 11, he's going to tell what should be done. Now, let us notice that the things that he's going to tell that should be done will apply not only to the kings and not only to the judges, but it also will apply to all mankind. And, of course, it would be well and good and proper if kings would recognize this, if they would put these precepts into their governments, into their laws, and into the basis for their rulership over people. But nevertheless, it not only applies to kings, but it applies to mankind every place, because the last phrase says, blessed are all they that put their trust in him. So we know that we're talking about all persons, not just kings and rulers. But since the first part of the psalm is about what the kings and rulers' reaction is going to be against the Messiah, then the first part of the instruction as to what to do about him is applied to them. He says in verse 11, serve the Lord with fear. So the thing to do to the Lord is to serve him, to serve the Lord with fear. This word for fear means reverence or apprehension. Serve him with the realization that he is monitoring what you do, that he has feelings about what you do. He's going to take action in judgment, either for or against you, based upon what you do. So you serve him with one eye upon this fact, the fact that we are to have some respect for him, and that our souls are going to be judged based upon what our actions, what our deeds are in regard to service to him. Now when we serve someone or something, we then dedicate ourselves to that service. This means that we use our minds, our thoughts, our thought processes. It means we also use our energies, the abilities that we may have physically to carry out this service. It also means that we use our resources, our financial resources, our influence, whatever power we may have, whatever ability we may have, we put it into this service. And we serve him with the idea that we are going to produce the kind of service that's going to be well-pleasing to him. We're going to do the thing that's going to make him satisfied with us. Because even though we should serve him, if it's the wrong kind of service, if it's not what he wants, if it's not what is well-pleasing to him, then we have more reason to fear because we have not satisfied him. We have not done that which is well-pleasing in his sight. And we know from other teaching in the Bible that if we do not do that that's well-pleasing to him, then it's going to be in vain. Our service will be for naught, and we don't want that to happen. So serve the Lord with fear. That is, with a feeling that I'm going to do the thing that's going to be well-pleasing to him. And then he says in the last part of that sentence, and rejoice with trembling. Now, to rejoice with trembling is interpreted or translated to mean to shout. And with trembling is to do it with reverence and awe, so that there is a joy. There is a feeling of pleasure. There is a feeling of satisfaction as a result of serving him. And you can have joy. You can have a release of your feelings. You can feel like everything is all right and demonstrate this and have an outward exhibition of it. But you do it with this reverence and awe, with respect to him. We do not do anything that is out of the realm of respect and service to him. So those that serve the Lord, those that serve the Lord with fear, then they are going to be able to rejoice and do it with trembling or with reverence and awful respect for him. And in verse 12, we have a little bit more of a problem of properly interpreting this. He begins the verse by saying, kiss the Son, lest he be angry. Now, this phrase, to kiss, really includes the Oriental method of greeting or recognizing a ruler. It means to simply show recognition of or to acknowledge. And the kissing could be on the hand or the garment or the feet or other parts of the body. But the idea is that you simply show deep recognition of. To refuse to greet a ruler in this manner would be then to openly refute him as being in this position of rulership. And so it's simply a statement advising that one acknowledge, that one show recognition to the Son. And another very interesting thing about this is that most of the translations and some of the Bible scholars say that this word for Son should not be translated as Son, but it should be translated as discipline or doctrine. And so what he may be saying here is to simply embrace or show recognition to the doctrine, to the teachings that are given with the reign of the Son of God. So kiss the doctrine, embrace the discipline, show some kind of change in your life that recognizes the fact that you are now being ruled by his laws. lest he be angry. Now, he here can refer to God in heaven, the Lord. Unless he be angry with your actions for shunning the Son or the doctrine, for not following after his laws, his commandments. And we know, of course, that if we love him, that we will keep his commandments. And we know also from what the New Testament teaches that the only way we can know that we're saved is if we are keeping the commandments of God. In 1 John, the second chapter, John makes this very plain to us, beginning with the third verse. And hereby we do know that we know him, if we keep his commandments. Now this seems to be telling us that the only evidence of faith is whether or not we're keeping his commandments. And he says further in the fourth verse, he that saith I know him, and keepeth not his commandments, is a liar, and the truth is not in him. But whoso keepeth his word, in him verily is the love of God perfected. Hereby know we that we are in him. Now that's very plain and emphatic teaching. And it also gives very strong evidence that the commands of God are imperative if we're going to be saved. We must keep the commands. It's the only way we can know that we know him. It's not a matter of simply how we feel. If we feel like everything's all right, if we feel saved, if we have this good, secure feeling inside, it's a matter of whether or not we're keeping his commandments. That's the only way we can know that we know him. It's not whether or not we've been miraculously inspired by the Holy Spirit. It's not whether or not we can go out here and do some kind of miracles or speak in tongues. That's not the way we know that we know him. That's not the way we know that we're in him and saved. But it's whether or not we're keeping his commandments. And so this passage here in the 12th verse of this second psalm says, kiss the Son, or kiss the doctrine. Embrace the doctrine, lest he be angry. And as a result of this, he says, and ye perish from the way. Now, you perish from the way. The way here is the way that you're going to be walking. You perish from the way that you're traveling. You either perish along the wayside and do not get there, or you leave the way and go the wrong direction. And to perish from the way is to definitely be lost. You're going to be destroyed. You're going to be made to cease to exist as even having a possibility of getting to him. You perish from the way. So we see how important not only the Son is, but the doctrine, following the teaching, the commands that he's given. It's most important, lest he be angry and you perish from the way. This is the result that's going to be when we fail to obey him, when we fail to do the things that are proper in his sight. You perish from the way. When his wrath is kindled but a little. So we see then that this failure to acknowledge him, or his doctrine, whatever the word Son means, the failure to embrace, to show recognition of him and his doctrine, causes him to be angry. And then this then will cause you to perish from the way when his wrath is kindled but a little. Now, it's a kindling of his wrath. It's an exciting of his feelings of displeasure when we do not recognize him. When we go another way besides recognize him. It's the same as if we were among that angry mob that shouted, crucify him, whenever we fail to recognize him. When we go our own way, as though he didn't exist, or as though we may be ashamed of him, or as though maybe we could do quite well without him. This kindles wrath on the part of God. This kindles displeasure on his part. Now, we certainly do not want to have our Creator, the one who is going to judge us, the one who has our whole destiny in the palm of his hand. We do not want him to be angry with us. We do not want to excite his displeasure. We do not want to cause him to feel that we are worthy of punishment or destruction or to be made to perish from the way. But that's precisely what is described here as what is going to happen if we find ourselves not embracing him, not recognizing him. Now, he talks about when his wrath is kindled but a little. And this phrase, but a little, is translated to mean soon. It means having to do with time rather than having to do with the amount of wrath he's going to have. So, his wrath is going to be soon. And when you stop and look at it, we only have our little bit of time that we spend on this earth. However many years that is. If it's 20 years, if it's 40 years, 60 years, 80 years, 100 years, doesn't really matter that much. We have a very small time when we compare ourselves to eternity. And so it is a soon time then that we're going to have to face Him. Not going to be long, we're going to be facing the Lord in the judgment. And His wrath there will be just a short ways from us if we make His wrath to be kindled against us. So let's not do the things that upset Him. Let's not do the things that cause His wrath to be kindled against us. But let's rather acknowledge His Son. Let's rather also acknowledge His doctrine. Let's embrace it. Let's serve Him with this reverential awe, this fear that we should have, so that we then can have the joy in the Lord that we should have, and rather than to kindle His wrath against us. And we see here that this is very plain language, actually, when we stop and see what's being said. We, by not doing what God would have us to do about His Son, we, by not recognizing Him, by not following His doctrine, by not keeping His commandments, we then simply are kindling His wrath against us. We're causing Him to take action that's going to make us perish from the way. We're going to be lost forever, lost from having any hope of salvation. Our souls are going to perish, no longer to be able to serve Him, no longer to be able to even know Him or to see Him, but we're going to be banished from His presence in an eternal state. Then he concludes in the last sentence by saying, "Blessed are all they that put their trust in Him." Now this includes not only kings and rulers, but it includes all mankind. Whoever is a human being upon this earth and who has the ability to know and to acknowledge, they will be blessed if they put their trust in Him. Now what does it mean to put your trust in Him? What does it mean to put your trust in anything? It means simply that you are committing yourself to Him. I think we can illustrate this like this. If a person is going to make a parachute jump out of an airplane, well, once he jumps out of that airplane, then he is committed. He has his trust in the parachute and his ability to relate to that parachute. He believes that the parachute is going to get him down safely. And he can't keep on holding on with one hand to the airplane. He can't keep one foot inside the door of the airplane. He hasn't really put his trust in the parachute as long as he's doing that. But once he commits himself, then it's up to the ability of the parachute to get him down to earth safely. And so it is whenever we put our trust in Him. We must make Him our all. We must totally commit our lives to Him. And not say, well, I'm going to hold on to this or to that and kind of keep this outside of the area of religion. Because just maybe there's not anything to this Jesus Christ doctrine. It just may be that the church is not really what all it's cracked up to be. It just may be that I'm going to have to depend upon my own self for my future security. We're not really putting our trust in Him. But to really trust in Him and to make Him our all and to commit ourselves, our soul's eternal destiny, to commit that to Him, then that's putting their trust. That's putting trust in Him. And this sentence says, "Blessed are all they that do this." You're going to have a blessing. You're going to be well paid for your trouble. You're going to be amply rewarded for trusting in Him. And so we see then that the whole gist of this psalm is that rather than to neglect Him or ignore Him or even to work against Him, we are to work for Him. We're to work with Him. We're to allow Him to be our Master, our Savior, and then we will be in the blessed state. A state that is contrasted with being lost. Rather than being lost and perish from the way, we're going to be blessed. And of course, whenever God gives us blessing, then we have very great riches. We are a person with a true inheritance, a true treasure, a treasure that's going to go beyond this life, a treasure that's going to go into the eternal state. And that's really what we want. That's what every human being desires and needs. And this psalm is telling us what we can have and how we can have it. We can be blessed. We can all be blessed. All they that put their trust in Him will be blessed. But it also tells us the fearful other side of the coin. If we reject Him, if we neglect Him, then we're going to be in a state of perishing from the way. We're going to have to face His wrath, which will soon be kindled against us. We have a picture of this judgment day in Matthew 25, beginning with the 31st verse. When the Son of Man shall come in His glory, and all the holy angels with Him, then shall He sit upon the throne of His glory. And before Him shall be gathered all nations, and He shall separate them one from another, as a shepherd divideth his sheep from the goats. And He shall set the sheep on His right hand, but the goats on the left. Then shall the king say unto them on His right hand, Come, ye blessed of My Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was an hungered, and ye gave me meat. I was thirsty, and ye gave me drink. I was a stranger, and ye took me in. Naked, and ye clothed me. I was sick, and ye visited me. I was in prison, and ye came unto me. Then shall the righteous answer Him, saying, Lord, when saw we thee an hungered, and fed thee, or thirsty, and gave thee drink? When saw we thee a stranger, and took thee in, or naked, and clothed thee? Or when saw we thee sick, or in prison, and came unto thee? And the king shall answer and say unto them, Verily I say unto you, inasmuch as you've done it unto one of the least of these my brethren, you've done it unto me. Then shall he say also unto them on the left hand, Depart from me, ye cursed, into everlasting fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was an hungered, and ye gave me no meat. I was thirsty, and ye gave me no drink. I was a stranger, and ye took me not in. Naked, and ye clothed me not. Sick, and in prison, and ye visited me not. Then shall they also answer him, saying, Lord, when saw we thee an hungered, or a thirst, or a stranger, or naked, or sick, or in prison, did not minister unto thee? Then shall he answer them, saying, Verily I say unto you, inasmuch as ye did it not to one of the least of these, ye did it not to me. And these shall go away into everlasting punishment, but the righteous into life eternal. So this great judgment scene shows the results of either embracing the Son or rejecting the Son. And we do it by our love and service to our fellow man. We're going to close at that point. Till next time, this is NC Crouch saying goodbye, friends.